Welcome to the Peter Moon Podcast, brought to you by Sky Books and the music of Noosa. This is the second in a series of podcasts with Peter Moon regarding remote viewing.
I just want to clarify for the listening audience that your questions might seem at the outset to steer a little bit away from the topic, but I'm going to address your questions because they're organic in nature, and they will come back to the subject of remote viewing. And in the future podcasts, we're going to try and stick to the core subject as much as possible. But in the same time, feel free to ask your question, Sean, and we'll continue. So carry on, and let me hear your first question.
Peter, I read a chapter in Synchronicity and the Seventh Seal that was about remote viewing. My first thought was, when I hear the term Seventh Seal, it goes to the apocalypse in the Bible. And as I read and searched a little more, I found a publishing you did, the Montauk Pulse, which talked about the Seventh Seal more as a level of knowledge that you achieve and not the whole Bible end of the world thing. Is that a fair understanding?
Yes. The chapter you're referring to in the book I wrote, Synchronicity and the Seventh Seal, is chapter 10. It's called Quantum Attack. And it goes into the sudden and rather unexpected public enthusiasm for this subject of remote viewing. And as I touched upon in the last podcast, Ingo Swann was mentioned as the father of remote viewers. And it's very interesting to me that this is the subject of Scientology that we were discussing in the last podcast is treated with such ridicule, but the remote viewing subject in the early 90s, after the publication of the Montauk Project, early to mid 90s, became just this just big fad. So you can kind of see where people's imaginations could be garnished or captured. And I will get around to answering your question, but first I want to point out that part of what's going on in the Montauk Project, or the more hidden powers of society, are to capture your attention. The game is about capturing attention, focusing attention, and directing it or redirecting it. And this is a power that the media either possesses or seeks to possess, is to direct your attention, on one hand, to consume particular products that are advertised by people who have a considerable amount of resources, and then they want to replenish those resources, etc., etc. So this is the fundamental game, as I alluded to, if not clearly stated in the last podcast, it's about power. And, of course, remote viewing gives the impression, when one discusses the subject of remote viewing, where one can see from a distance or perceive from a distance to have perception, that one can penetrate certain layers of perception or consciousness that one would not ordinarily have, and thereby empower oneself. But you see, the bigger issue is the power of the body politic. And so I want to restate this and state it clearly, that it's really an issue of empowerment and self-empowerment more than it is, wow, what is this neat thing that this guy's saying who was in the government, and he can tell us all about these things, and he has all these phony credentials that appear to be real credentials, although the person saying that is not thinking of them as phony credentials. And they may not, indeed, not be phony in terms of having an actual position in the government, but then you have to see, well, you know, it might be likened in certain cases to, well, yeah, I have an Iron Cross from the Nazi Party. So we have to take this in the context. But to get back to your question about the seventh seal and the apocalypse, the apocalypse is a very misunderstood term. And, of course, it's been convoluted and Christianized. And you have to look at the very etymology of the word itself, the phonetics as well. Apocalypse means apo, which means to uncover or to reveal, like open up. And calypso. This is from the Greek. Calypso was a Greek goddess. Apocalypso, apocalypse. And calypso, I think they did a theatrical rendition of Calypso, a very corny one in one of those Johnny Depp movies, Pirates of the Caribbean.
Right.
And Calypso was a goddess who in the Odyssey, Ulysses or Odysseus had 7 years of sexual initiation on the island of Ogygios. And I wrote about some of the specific esoteric threads that go into Atlantean history in my book, The Montauk Book of the Living. A lot of personal synchronicity with connecting obliquely to this island off the coast of Northwest Africa, Ogygios. Might be pronounced another way as well. So, is the apocalypse is the uncovering of the goddess or the female principle, the goddess energy. And of course, if you study my work, which I know you haven't yet, all of it, in the early work, the book Montauk Revisited goes into the underpinnings of the occult forces behind the Montauk Project, the occult threads, which do tie into the concept, the archetype of the beast and the personage of Aleister Crowley. And it was through the study of those connections and synchronicity that I was able to meet, quite by happenstance and pure synchronicity, was this lady, Marjorie Cameron, who was the focal point of the magical work known as the Babylon Working, which was basically a magical ritual that started with Jack Parsons and Scientology founder L. Ron Hubbard, who was not the founder of Scientology at that point. And Parsons in particular, invoked an elemental, which he needed to finish the work, which Marjorie Cameron came to his door after a traffic accident. She wound up at his door, and he engaged her in this work, and she became a symbolic focal point of the work, the Babylon Working. And again, Babylon is, now see, here, this ties into the seventh seal, and at least the concept of the seventh seal, because Babylon is the name for an ancient goddess, Babylon, and Baba, the gateway. And just like a female is termed a gateway because it's through her loins that we're gated into the earth.
Right.
And this gateway of what comes in and out of consciousness is echoed in the menstrual experience for women, whereby they actually are detoxing the experiences. Some of those experiences are very toxic, that women have to detox all the crime and negative energy that goes through the morphogenetic grid. And this is the cryings out. When the woman cries in menstruation or feels this emotion, she's an echo of what's going on the entire process of life. And this was ancient times and matriarchal societies. This was a sacred time for women. And they would do this alone. So when you try to just throw them into society, it's sort of a conflict of energies, when they're expected to do ordinary things during their sacred time, which was meant to be sacred, and we live in a society that does not recognize, let alone honor, this principle. So when you have women in, like, all in sync, when they're all a bunch of women around living in a house, they'll all begin to have their periods at the same time. Yes. Because it's really a group activity. So this gets into a whole other esoteric aspect of existence, which our society does not recognize. But when you say the seventh seal and the uncovering of Calypso, or the goddess, you can take it a little more deeply and say, what is this word Calypso? I describe the goddess Calypso as known to either mythology or history, depending on how you look at it. And Calypso is Kali Ipso. Kali is the ancient goddess we know of the Hindu pantheon, and Ipso is bifact of in Greek. So you have bifact of Kali. So we have Apocalypso, the uncovering by the fact of Kali. And Kali is very key because she's often thought as a devourer, but she is the essence of time. So Kali is time, and this is where we get the words calendar. Kali.
Is she the same divine goddess of paganism and witches? Is that the same goddess?
Well, let me clarify that. Okay. Hinduism is a pagan religion.
Right.
So, and just so you understand the word pagan, as it is per the dictionary, is there, and you can look it up, but by definition, I will clarify this, that by definition, a pagan is anyone, any religion or belief system, who is not a follower of Judaism, Christianity, or Islam. And what the common denominator of those three religions are Abraham, who, according to some sources that are perhaps a little more enlightened than the typical sources, it comes from Abrahamin, like Abrahamin, a Brahmin priest. And this is, he comes from the East. Or the East came from an earlier tradition that he was named after. And you can say that Abraham was of that tradition that migrated from East to West, or came from it, which would actually be prior to the migration East to Hinduism and the migration West towards Israel, the land of Ur. And you can, I think they call it, spell it U-R, and this is your basic Urian.
Okay.
And Aryan. This can get, all gets mixed up with a lot of other things, but this is much more ancient. So anyway, Abraham is a patriarchal figure, and everything becomes slanted towards the father, the priest. He was a priest of Melchizedek, a very male patriarchal figure. So you have this character Melchizedek, which is what the Mormons are very obsessed with, Melchizedek. This is a very patriarchal figure. So I'm talking about an earlier matriarchal religion or way of life. And Kali is a goddess of time. So yes, pagans might, which a Wiccan would be a pagan just by definition, might pay tribute to Kali, and various factions. Usually Kali is portrayed in a negative aspect, although not uniformly. And she's a goddess of time, and there's something in the East known as the Kali Chakra, which is the wheel of time. So this is an ancient tradition that goes back into Tibet. And while the Buddhists acknowledge the Kali Chakra, and I didn't see it paid too much attention to in their literature, I pointed it out in my book, The Black Sun. Then it started to get more acknowledgement. as if they read the book, which I really don't suspect that they did. But Kala Chakra comes from an earlier tradition known as the Bon tradition, B-O-N. And that tradition had an earlier name, which was Mon, M-O-N, which goes back to the moon, goes back to the moon as the cycles of time. And this is the root of where we get the word Montauk, for one. But I've studied these things very deeply. But this is the uncovering of time in another sense. And when you talk about the apocalypse, there is a consistency with the Christian legends or literature that it is the end of time. So at the end of time, you have all these archetypes reaching up out of the Bible to which have a tendency to scare the living daylights out of people, or certainly get their attention in a very theatrical way that's going to shake their emotions. It becomes, people emotionally respond to the Bible because they've been indoctrinated not only to the Bible, but they've been indoctrinated emotionally, spiritually, to react like they just saw something in a haunted house. It kind of scares them. It's not exactly the same, but it's very similar.
Thank you for listening to the Peter Moon Podcast. To purchase Peter's books, visit skybooksusa.com. Also visit Peter's blog at digitalmontauk.com. And to hear more music by Noosa, visit noosasounds.com.
So I've answered partially your question there with regard to the apocalypse, and we're still on the subject of remote viewing, but all this ties together. It comes around full circle, because when we talk about the seventh seal, of course, this is an analogy that's written in the book of Revelation, and Aleister Crowley points out something very astute about the book of Revelation. He doesn't say it's true. He doesn't say it's not. He doesn't say it's not true. What he said, it's a potent, magical piece of writing. And all you have to do is see how much effect it has created upon the population to see that it is somebody had an intent, and somebody got a whole lot of audience there with a whole lot of emotional hooks into the body populace of what they were writing to. So here we're analyzing the book of Revelation in an analytical way and also an emotional way to reinspect who wrote this, why did they write this, and, you know, was it the divinely inspired word of who? You're asking who? And these are fundamental existential questions that everybody should ask without being accepting. You shouldn't accept something because somebody told you. You should accept something after your own personal inspection of it. So where your mind goes with your own personal inspection is your business. But back to the seventh seal concept, ancient man saw everything in terms of seven. And when the sevens did not appear, he would turn them into sevens. And because that was what his mind knew was true. And you can see this in the seven colors of the spectrum: red, orange, yellow, green, indigo, blue, and violet. That's your basic seven. You break down the spectrum, you have seven. Now you can get different shades of green and different aspects of yellow and all those wonderful colors if you want to break it down further. But if you heat a piece of metal, you'll see those seven colors again, and watch it go through, watch the flame turn different colors as you heat a piece of metal or get it so hot. So basically, you're dealing with sevens. They used to know seven planets because they didn't know about Uranus and Neptune and Pluto. And when there were seven, there was always a relationship between seven and five, because this, two of these aspects of the seven were hidden. So, for example, they had five planets that they knew, and they had the sun and the moon. The sun and the moon are not really planets, and they knew they weren't really planets. And they also had the concept of seven chakras, seven wheels in the body. These are energy centers that would appear, if you could see the energy fields of them according to the ancient doctrine, which would be included in both Hinduism and Kala Chakra, is you see these seven energy centers of the body. And this is pretty much pedestrian esotericism, is that you have the first chakra, which concerns with survival, the second chakra concerns with the sexual processes and reproduction, the third chakra is the power center, where the lion is going to go to get his food and exercise his power and protect his pride. The fourth chakra is the heart. And the heart chakra not only is where you really begin to embrace true emotion, but it is the integration of the higher and the lower, the outside and the inside. And research has revealed that there's a brain center in the heart. And we can argue about which one's more important, the one in the heart or the one in the head. Well, they're meant to correspond to each other. But this is the integration. And in all of this metaphysical mishmash that people get into is, or if it's not mishmash, if it's clear, the way when it becomes chaotic, you clear it through the heart, because everything has to ultimately be processed through the heart. So this is, we talk about grounding. We talk about flying, you know, getting over our heads into the ether. The heart is what's the center between the two points. You don't want to be totally on the ground, and you don't want to be totally in the heavens. You want to have a balance between the heaven and the earth. And the fifth chakra is communication, known as the throat chakra. It's how you extend yourself into the physical world through the sounds. It may not be speech, it may be grunts, it may be a growl, depending on the type of species you are. And I was talking about the relationship between the five and the seven. You have two mysterious aspects. You have the mind, the third eye, your sixth chakra, and this is your gift. And then the seventh chakra, your gift of being able to see, think, or perceive. The mind has everything to do with perception. And of course, the seventh chakra is the crown chakra, and that's the embracement of the totality of all things. Now, there are systems that have more than seven, but this is basically your basic rudimentary concept. And the seventh chakra is the crowning glory of consciousness, God. It's the step of the last step of the ladder as you step into the realm of heaven, literally. But once you step into heaven, there is the ladder's still there. And all those people at the bottom of the ladder are still there. So there becomes a relationship between heaven and the earth that is existing independent of yourself, if you are so lucky as to climb that ladder. Or so unfortunate, as is in the case of The Ring Cycle by Richard Wagner, the opera. I can't pronounce the German.
Okay.
Boy, so I'm not going to... But the first one that features Rheingold is where, at the end of the opera, all of the gods are going to Valhalla, and Loki, who is the one that enables them to find the Ring of Power... he's intimately connected to the Ring of Power. And he looks at them like they're crazy when they're going into Valhalla, because they're walking up the ladder, or the equivalent of the ladder, and they think they're going where they're never going to have to answer to anything. You can just see it, at least in the rendition I saw. And he's looking at them like they're crazy, because what do they think? They're going to have to come back here. They haven't escaped anything, because he knows the lower world. He's of the lower world. So even when you reach the top of the ladder, you still have to be responsible for the other end. And so that is a very long-winded response to your question about the seventh seal and what it represents. And the Christian version is written in much, it's written topically to the top, to the topics of the times.
Sure.
But it's also based upon earlier, as is everything in the New Testament, is based upon earlier literature, knowledge, traditions, and mystery school initiations. So that happens to be one that has stuck with us, and there's astrological reasons it stuck with us, because we're still under the influence of that realm of Pisces, and part of that age includes manipulation and deception. So in any case, I hope I've answered your question.
You have, thank you. And also in this chapter, you were talking more about Ingo Swann. You gave a lot more specifics about him. One thing that I found fascinating when you talked about remote viewing were the dangers involved in it that I was not aware of. First of all, I thought it was a psychic gift of his and not something that someone could actually learn. And I enjoyed your explanation leading up to that into what Scientology had studied. One thing you mentioned was that when someone is in an, how did you phrase it, an exterior state from the body,
right,
that they are vulnerable to many different things. I could see how we can just go off in incredible tangents in some of these conversations, but this is all just so fascinating to me.
Yes, as I stated in the earlier podcast, exteriorization is a state of being that one is either expected or, well, it's expected that it will occur sooner or later as one begins to process one's own mind and as things begin to move out. And exterior just means that you're aware of yourself independent of your body. Independent of your body and the perceptions of the body. The body has its obvious perceptions, which we're all familiar with. And sometimes you will have perceptions, and I'm sure most people have experienced this, where they said, wow, where did that come from? I smell something. I smell apple pie. But the apple pie you're smelling is going to be at your aunt's house later for Thanksgiving, because there's no apple pie. You live out in the woods. There's no apple pie around. So you smell the apple pie.
Right.
But you're going to your aunt's house for Thanksgiving, and there, oh, that's the apple pie I smelled. There are instances where people have these experiences. Sometimes they will see things that aren't there, and sometimes these sights will not be in the same sights that you see in the physical plane. You won't see it the same way you'll see it visually. Sometimes it can be, you can see exactly like you would see with your physical eyes. It depends on the experience, because there's an infinity of types of experiences one can have in what is called the exterior state. Now, I have seen it vigorously debated that there are no exterior states, that this does not happen, that Scientology is fake, bop, 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 and that this is all a bunch of a scam, et cetera, et cetera. Well, I can only speak from my own experience. I was very, I guess what you'd say, careful and cautious, and would always lean back to scientific reference frames for is something possible, is something not possible, because I studied science fiction, and science fiction was great because you could just jump off into the ozone, so to speak, on some theory. And science fiction is all based upon what is called extrapolation. You take existing scientific principles or paradigms, and then you extend upon those, logical progressions upon those, and then you can jump off on your platform for a story that is theoretically based upon science and not fantasy. That's the difference. Whereas fantasy, you can just say, you know, a magic lamp came and I created a magic carpet and boy, I was flying all over the place. Whereas a science fiction book is going to be much more meticulous and conservative in describing how the magic lamp works and how the flying carpet works, even if it's going to break it down into vibrations and whatnot. But that's your basic difference between science fiction and fantasy. So in an exterior state, that was something that, I guess, when I first read about it, I didn't really have any conception of it. I didn't know what it was. I said, okay, this is what they're saying. And in the case of Scientology, they had like, oh, this whole gradation chart, which is all the levels of awareness you could theoretically move up to. And you had all these books and that were talking about this. Now, it was all very new to me. And I was primarily interested in going into those regions of my mind and finding out what was there and clearing them out. I was very directed towards that. I liked this idea of exterior, but I wasn't sold on it. I had my own agenda. Now, I thought, wow, all that appeals to me, and if I can clear out this, maybe I'm open to this. But it had no experiential reality to me. So I could say that I studied a course on Dianetics, and that was different than the book, because you had about 21 years or so of experience that was put into course materials which complemented the book and vice versa of the techniques in that book, which were considered to be more advanced. And it was really teaching one to actually help another go back and retrieve their experiences, starting very, very lightly, very gently, in terms of going back into those moments of your life which were not painful, which were happy. And that sort of loosens up the entire mind to going back into deeper issues and clearing out the sludge, which were the ultimate sludge in a mind, according to the theories of Dianetics, was an engram, which was a moment of pain and unconsciousness. And to relieve that pain and unconsciousness so that it was no longer painful and it was no longer unconscious. And you're now awake back in that area, and all the trauma that occurred in that area was not happening. It's relieved. And these would go back into a chain of experiences. So my first experience in actually receiving that type of what was called Dianetic auditing resulted in an exterior state. But I did not know it at the time. I did not realize it. I was out of my body and kind of flying all over the room, so to speak.
Right.
Metaphorically. Well, I would have thought it was metaphorically, but I was just completely relieved, completely extroverted. I wouldn't even see the words. I wasn't extroverted in the sense that I was feeling great, like, oh, let's all go do this. No, it was like I extroverted from my body. And I was just like, had extinguished the trauma of hundreds or thousands of, I don't know how many, what it was, thousands or hundreds of years. It seemed like about 1,000 years of trauma. And the reality of this to me, it was all about, had to do with a sore throat that would recur in my experience. And it relieved the sore throat. The sore throat has not come back to this day. It was one of my, you know, because it would have had the biggest, what was called, reaction on the Scientology e-meter. Wow. And this was all fresh in my mind. I mean, I was ready to experience this. I didn't know I was ready to experience it. And it relieved me so tremendously that, wow, this kind of like makes you like the subject of Scientology. It makes you like the subject of Dianetics. And it makes you appreciate or respect L. Ron Hubbard, if not like him.
Right.
A like really wasn't an issue so much as you say, wow, this person put together this string of information that enabled this character, who happened to be named Tom Stevens, sitting across from me, And he's asking me these questions in a very rote, sort of formal way, but not without personal attention and care, that it enables me to relieve these mental, whatever it was, that was holding all this insisted energy in place that I didn't even know I had. So, wow, what a wonderful experience. And I could say that that might have been one of the most dramatic auditing sessions I ever had, and I had many good ones, many dramatic ones, but that was like, wow, because it was sort of the first one. It really was the first one for all practical purposes, and it's like, wow. Now, even though I would deem that I was in an exterior state, is that all of my auditing after that point began to go sour. And it just didn't work. They said I needed a review, and that required more money, which even when I got the money together, the review didn't work. So I guess a higher classed auditor, which was counselor, came to run all the technical procedures in Scientology. That was back in 1971. He came and he was there to sort out any of the problems. He was a permanent staff member.
It almost sounds like past life regression.
It is past life regression. It's just
okay.
It's past life regression. But what I was going to say is, and I'm getting back to your state of exterior.
Right.
And I remember this man. I remember his name. It was Paul Armstrong. He was also known for playing at some point with Country Joe and the Fish. He was a part of their band.
Really?
Yeah. Although, yeah. So anyway, he had looked at my folder and says, ask, you know, I was supposed to be asked, did you go exterior in your auditing? And the answer on the e-meter was obviously yes. I don't remember what I answered personally, but they basically said, you don't need a review, you need a different rundown. And it was called the interiorization-exteriorization rundown. And I say interiorization forward slash exteriorization rundown. And this was a set of procedures to go back and run out those moments of pain and unconsciousness that had you, that there were engrams against moments of pain and unconsciousness associated with going in and out of the body. Now, because even though I had gone exterior, I was a little lost. I didn't know what had happened. I was very happy about what had happened, but I couldn't do the normal auditing procedures. I wasn't responding to them. And so a lot of what we'd call mental mass would move in, insisted energy and whatnot, and I wasn't able to respond, at least per the way the meter showed. So that, which is basically a galvanometer, you know, getting the resistance in your skin, but it also influences what's going in and around the person's mental and emotional state. So basically, from that point, you clear out this negative energy that could be associated with either real, imagining, or imaginary incidents where you went in and out of the body. And I found myself running past deaths that I still to this day do not know are real or unreal. One was in an airplane where I was piloting an airplane. It was somewhat similar to a World War I airplane whereby, you know, when you crash, you know, you get juxtaposed against the machinery and the controls and kind of, you know, boom. And so this was, of course, I did all this stuff and I relieved it. And I say to this day, I can't tell you objectively whether it was true or not. And I didn't care.
Right.
Because all this trauma that I didn't even know I had was leaving me. And the whole object of that rundown, which only took about 5 hours, was to put you in a state of being to where you could go in or out of the body without any upset or gyration. So, and here I was, a real new Scientologist. I had not even been involved in it for a year, and I had experienced, wow. So I could remember riding my bicycle home after getting this rundown and going by the graveyard. And I always thought graveyards were kind of creepy. I don't know about you. And all of a sudden, I can feel the energy of the graveyard, and it did not cause me to introvert or go over. I was like, wow, those are just a bunch of dead souls that they're hanging around their old bodies, so to speak. Right. It was a different attitude. It was a different attitude that I have, and I was no longer afraid of graveyards. Not that I was afraid of them, but, you know, I didn't get the creeps when I go by them. And I just kind of like look and say, ah, you felt like you could say hello to the spirits if you want to and sit down and have a conversation if you wanted to,
yeah.
Which was my predisposition. And in any case, this is just giving you sort of a personal organic experience of what I went through. And it's something I really never talked about too much.
Part of the process in getting to the state of a clear mind is actually trying to rid yourself of garbage that you've retained from past lives?
Well, that would be a part of it. That's certainly one of the attitudes or statements of Scientology.
I was just thinking out loud, kind of. But
yes, that's fine.
Fascinating.
Yeah, well, see, the escape clause for me in Scientology, and there was an escape clause, and I eventually escaped, is... And I will refer you to the movie Damn Yankees, if you've ever seen that movie Damn Yankees, where the guy who sells his soul to the devil has an escape clause.
Yeah.
Insists upon the escape clause because he's a real estate agent. So I always had an escape clause that says, well, it doesn't matter whether this stuff is real or not, because it's what I experience. It's like, wow, look what I get back. It was, you know, you give me this, I get this, wow. And believe you me, there are a lot of people that experienced things, and I can't compare my experience to their experience.
Right.
But so when you talk to somebody who's had a somewhat similar experience to me that I just gave you,
yeah,
and they are your friend, or you know them, and you may not even know them that well, you say, wow, look at this, wow, and all of a sudden you have an understanding and a sharing of life that is very deep. And it's very like, wow, look at this. And you can have the greatest times together and form the greatest friendships in a context where you understand each other because you've both been through something, much like a long journey through Antarctica when you lived and, you know, went through some horrendous things. But this is not a horrendous experience. This is like, wow. And you actually have something in common. One of the features or principles of Scientology, as it was stated, was when you had this rundown that relieved you from trauma of going in or out of the body, you were then informed that you might need it again in the future. And there were instances where I did need it again in the future. It might have been years later or a year later when you had other experiences that caused you to introvert a little further. And maybe you'd revisit that incident in the airplane and see, well, you didn't get all of that insisted charge in it. And, yeah, there was some gunner who also shot you or something. So whatever
right.
happened. So that was a feature. And I thought this was one of, like, for all of the misgivings that might be attributed to L. Ron Hubbard, these procedures that he developed, and he did develop them, they like to say that all these other people did what he did and he just copied it.
Yeah.
You know, he developed these. For this alone, I said, wow, who's ever else done anything like that?
Right. And in your chapter that you sent me, you described the different terminologies like OBE for...
Oh. That's an important point. He didn't use that terminology. And I'll clarify, OBE is what in common society now they have the out-of-body experience. The
yes.
OBE, they call it, the OBE. They don't call it exterior. They call it out-of-body experience. They're synonyms. And one of the ways OBEs got recognized, and I mean they were always recognized in the traditions of spirituality going back to the Theosophical movement and prior and later to that, was the state of the spirit as opposed to the body. What Hubbard said about the body, mind, spirit was not new. But the techniques he employed, you know, Aleister Crowley, they say all of this stuff came from Aleister Crowley. Well, Crowley did not have techniques for relieving people of this affliction. His techniques were pretty pretty dubious, even when they worked for somebody. So, in any case, this this technique was just wow. And as you go back forward in time, and as you see the Scientology movement change and morph into something certainly far from what I knew it when I got involved in it, I can't compare the two. One is like a mock, the current day movement is like a mockery of what I experienced, in a very low order mockery thereof. It just uses some of the same words, but with all of that being said, many people that I know or knew, they might not remember me vaguely because they've had so much experience, that were in that movement, they went through 30 years of being in Scientology and their elite organization called the Sea Organization, which I was once a member of. They never had these experiences. They never got auditing to the significant degree that it enabled them to have these experiences. And I felt, comparatively, looking at it retroactively, I said, wow, I was very fortunate that I got to smell, feel, and experience the real deal, including the real deal known as L. Ron Hubbard, not as these people who describe him, who know the bad memories that other people have shared with them. So there were good things, there were bad things, and there was a lot of shades of gray in between. But so you see, a lot of people didn't experience these things, and this takes us back to our issue with Ingo Swann, where I have a tendency to answer your questions in a very lengthy and deep way. So you have to be careful what you ask.
I appreciate it. I just learned more with the more you say. Earlier you were talking about, I guess I'm open to the exterior experience, in that, like when you were talking about apple pies, I've had the experience that I've mentioned to my sister. I've been like, have you ever had a breeze like take you back in time, where I felt like I've had an experience in the springtime when the wind blew by, and I felt like I was like back in grade school on Long Island on the playground. You know, bring me back in time to a certain area, and I've kind of written it off as deja vu, but I never knew, you know, what to call it. And I just find this all so fascinating.
Well, what that is a very beautiful poetic iteration of your life. I mean, it's beautiful. It's just poetic. It's dreamlike, and it's like it's you connecting to the past.
Right.
And in Scientology, one of the lower levels, and it was one, I thought it was one of the most fun levels, was called Straight Wire. And Straight Wire was to take you back to moments in time. You know, recall a time you were happy. You know, recall a time when you felt a breeze. There were all these different statements, and you can just make them up.
Sure.
Scientologists were not used to making up their own commands, but I mean, you could theoretically make up words. Think of a time when someone smiled at you. Think of a time when you ate something good. Think of a time when life was beautiful. And you go back and you start straight wiring these times, it increases your capacity for memory. It puts a straight wire back to you on the track of time, or the time track. And it increases your ability to pull up incidents out of your mind. And then once you have all these beautiful moments, then you can take on the moments that were not so good. that were not so good, and the traumatic moments. And the most traumatic moments you'll ever have or ever had are the ones that you didn't know were traumatic. In other words, you don't know that you've been traumatized. How many people during the Inquisition really believed that they were being traumatized by the Catholic Church?
Right.
Catholic Church is what they had all their faith in. They loved that, and I'm talking about the core Christians, because there were a lot of people that the Moors and the Jews who would convert to Catholicism just to save their skins and do it in name only. But your core Christians, or even in the latter-day Protestants, those people didn't think that they were being traumatized by the leaders of their church. And you take Martin Luther, who broke free from the Catholic Church because he believed he was being traumatized by the Catholic Church, and he believed everybody was being traumatized by the Catholic Church. And then what did they have left? They had a quote-unquote sanitized Christianity, and they were interpreting Christianity for themselves. They were interpreting the Bible for themselves. But were they responding to trauma too? Why did it have to be Christianity? Because that's what they grew up into. If they had grown up with the Aborigines in Australia, they wouldn't even be thinking about Christianity. So the environment is, you know, what happens. So it's very interesting when you take this proposition that L. Ron Hubbard was nuts, and everything he said about these atom bombs and volcanoes was all crazy. Well, it certainly sounds crazy, but I have heard from independent sources that will tell you that this planet, and when I say independent sources, I'm talking about the people of biodynamics.
Okay.
And dynamics is the life energy in plants. And Rudolf Steiner coined the word, but there's other people that believe in the life energy of plants. And according to the tests they have done, and I believe that it's even had some ordinary scientific corroboration, is that there is evidence that there was atomic blasts on this planet in ancient history. Not as far back as L. Ron Hubbard says, but nevertheless, atomic trauma that traumatized whatever life forms were on the Earth.
Right. I've read about that as well.
Yes. So what I'm saying is, people will point the finger at the ludicrousness of L. Ron Hubbard, or the apparent or alleged ludicrousness of him and his theories. What I would say, what's important here, is not whether he was right. Not whether he was right at all is not what's important. Is what about the trauma? Was he addressing a trauma? And was he addressing it astutely or not astutely? Well, recent information that has come to me from Douglas Dietrich says that L. Ron Hubbard was indeed very traumatized by the atomic blast, because it was his job to witness people being subjected to the atomic blast. And this was of a very high secret clearance. This is a part of his history that Douglas Dietrich witnessed and was assigned to burn the records thereof, because he said that his record was falsified, his military records were falsified, and that he was traumatized by the military, by these experiences that he did while serving in the military, and he wanted help from the military. They did not give it to him, and he made out on his own, for better or for worse. So you can say that if you were to look into the psyche of this man, and his psyche has been, I guess, delved into deeper than any other person's psyche in the history of this world, as far as I know. Because people don't dig into the the psyche of the character we know as Jesus Christ. They don't go deeply into his psyche because it's all kind of, what they know of him is kind of straightforward in the New Testament. There's nothing else there. It's a pretty small aspect, so you can't dig up his life and say, why did he push this kid off the roof? You know, as it appears in one of the Gnostic Gospels, where he pushes some kids off the roof.
Right.
The guy brings them back, or they mysteriously come back again. There's not really a lot to deeply dig into Jesus Christ. The devil is not treated as a real character, per se. Aleister Crowley has been vilified, but nobody really ever goes too deeply into his psyche. And when they do, they don't do a very good job of it. They just kind of look at all the crap and relay that. They don't look at him as a human being. And it's been pointed out to me by one of my friends and fans that what I did in my books is I humanized Crowley. I looked at him as a real human being. Not basically advocating him, but just saying, you know, this guy was a human being.
Right.
And not judging him in the same way that you would judge a criminal that you are ready to throw into the pit. Whether he should be thrown into the pit or not is really irrelevant because he was already in the pit.
Yeah,
and that's one of the reasons Charles Manson has psychological power over people, because he's in the pit, and he knows he's in the pit, and he's not afraid of being in the pit, and you're afraid of being in the pit, you know?
Yeah.
That's kind of the power that he exercises over people. In the case of Hubbard, you know, people will see this, but they don't necessarily see that the later day processes that he evolved for the upper levels of Scientology, which had to do with atomic blasts, had something to do with his own personal psyche. Well, they do acknowledge that it was his own personal case, if you will, which it certainly was, but what was the nature of this case and how come he went that way? But more important than that is this psychological and morphogenetic trauma that the planet has been subjected to, and all of the life forms on it? And are there components of what he said that were true? And if they were true, who in the world was unloading these atom bombs, and what was going on with them?
So, or who out of this world?
Well, out of this world or from another world.
Right.
His theory was that it was another world.
Yes.
But so I can certainly say that I've had some subjective experience in evaluating emotional trauma associated with these ideas. And one of the, now here's a totally independent source, and his name is Manly P. Hall, a very well-known, master mason, and as the Philosophical Research Society he built and established in Los Angeles. He's passed away many years now, but he has a lot of tapes you can listen to on YouTube. And there's one, I think it's on Buddhism and the atom bomb.
Okay.
I don't know if that's the title, but he talks about a spiritual practice whereby you had to feel the blast of an atomic bomb. This is imaginary, subjectively, and not flinch in the eye of this atomic blast. Now, I believe this whole idea went back prior to when we had atomic bombs. It was something like that. Obviously, he would have given the lecture after the atomic age, but the whole idea of being blasted to smithereens and not being blasted, it's like, talk about taking a punch.
Yes.
It's the metaphorical punch that one is taking, and to fortify oneself against that alone is enough to give some idea of, I guess what you'd say, worth to such a technique. And of course, in Scientology, one was led on a garden path, ideally, so that one could approach these more heavy aspects of existence and trauma. And one of the reasons these outrageous, like, periods of years were given, whatever it was, billions or trillions of years ago, when there is no, I guess, analytical reference frame for saying this, is because this is what the response he'd get on the biofeedback, the meter, that would say this many years, this many years. That's how he would date things. He would date things off what the meter was telling him. And it wasn't necessarily a scientific, analytical reference frame, something like carbon dating would give you.
Right.
It was just like, oh, this is what it says. This is the path we're going. We're going to do this. And the reason he didn't try and break it down further, like I'm breaking things down further for you, is because he did not have to.
Yeah.
He didn't have to. You know, just like if you're a new player on a football team and the guy comes up and to the coach and says, why are we doing it that way? He says, just do it. You know, your job is not to ask why. Just run the play. And then, you know, maybe later you can come back and figure out why you ran that play after you've got a season or two under your belt. Why the mechanics of the team work the way they do. So he didn't have to, and he had other things to do. That sort of job of explaining things, the whys and wherefore, could be left for other people, and certainly people don't understand him too well. And part of the reason for this is that everything he dealt with concerned a lot of mental force and energy. And the mental force and energy, it's all about mental force and energy in that movement. And mental force and energy can be misused. But back to what we were originally talking about with the exterior state and the remote viewing, this is just one lens I'm giving you.
Yeah.
There could be lenses on this topic that have nothing to do with L. Ron Hubbard or Scientology. It just happens to be how I was introduced to this subject. But when we talk about force, say, of an atomic blast is just one example, when a person gets outside of the body, he is subjected to not only everything that's happened to him on the time track, but everything else out there that he might not have been subjected to that might be able to perceive his energy and countermand it, and countermand his energy if he gets too psychoactive. And psychoactive means spiritually active. The word psycho comes from psyche, psychoactive, spiritually active. So this is what we're talking about here with are there monitors? Are there people with, you know, the eye in the sky, or we have all these eyes around in big cities that can scrutinize what you're doing?
Right.
In the vast scheme of creation, did somebody figure out a methodology to scrutinize how a spirit manifests in space and how a spirit moves in space, and can that be detected? And as opposed to being in a body where one's just moving, you know, in the laboratory, running around, foraging for food and whatnot. But when one begins to come up and stand out, did somebody somewhere along this vast creation that we call the universe figure out some way to monitor an individual, to scrutinize him as he moves in space?
Right.
And this is really the proposition I'm talking about when we talk about remote viewing. Because when you get out and you can see, and you can see, okay, I see a pink cake. I want to buy this pink cake for my Valentine. You go down and you know that there will be a pink cake in that store, and you buy it for your Valentine, and you're all very happy. Nobody cares about that, yeah, except your Valentine and you. You're not stepping on anybody's toes. But I will tell you this. If you are ever so lucky to make a huge deposit at your local bank, you will be noticed, if only by the teller and the banker. But as a merchant once said to me, they were taught never to bank in the same town where they do business, because you don't want people in the town knowing how much money you make. Right. You don't want going around, because that banker is not sworn silent. He's not given an oath. And be careful as to who shows up at your door offering you dubious investments, because you know you've just put a bunch of money in an account.
Right.
And the type of literature you might get in the mail, inducing you to invest in something. So I'm using this, and you know, money is power, so I'm saying when you begin to move and strut your stuff out on the spiritual pathways of the ecosphere, look who comes knocking at your door.
Huh.
And what weapons do they have? What resources do they have? Do they want to hire you? Do they want to get rid of you? Do they want to ignore you? These are tests that one can expect. And I've certainly had some experience in this regard. And, you know, perhaps we can go into that in the next podcast.
Yeah, definitely.
Thank you for listening to the Peter Moon Podcast. To purchase Peter's books, visit skybooksusa.com. Also visit Peter's blog at digitalmontauk.com. And to hear more music by Noosa, visit noosasounds.com.
You know, as you were talking there, I was thinking about the book that I was reading by Ingo Swann. He mentions about remote viewing of the dark side of the moon, and while he was doing the remote viewing, it was like the beings he was viewing recognized him being there, like they felt something. And the government guy asked him to, you know, leave there, go to a different place. And also, it also reminded me of the holograph area in that Radu Sinemar talks about in Transylvanian Sunrise, about going into the viewing room and there being the holograph. Once you put your hand on it, you can go back in time, and him having gone back to the time of Jesus and saying that Jesus, like, almost like looked at him. Like, recognize that he was there.
Excuse me, you're skewing the books a little bit. I just want to clarify.
Oh, yes, I'm sorry.
You're mixing apples with oranges here. Oh. Basically, the book Transylvania Sunrise does feature a table where he puts his hand over. One can put their hand over and have a readout of their DNA. But that's different than what's called the projection hall, where one can actually, where he actually witnessed the history of time. That was bioresonant with his own psyche.
Oh, okay.
What you're talking about, going back and seeing Jesus, occurs in the book Mystery of Egypt, which you must have just read. And he talks about going back and you said seeing the face of Jesus?
Yes.
Well, okay, go ahead. And I just wanted to clarify that and go ahead and ask your question.
You had mentioned with, you know, remote viewing and the dangers of an exterior being in a spiritual realm and what you can experience and all the different things that can happen. I just thought it was similar between that portion of going back and seeing Jesus and having him recognize the person that was viewing Jesus. Is that the same as remote viewing?
Well, him recognizing the person that was viewing Jesus in that experience in the third book of the series, Mystery of Egypt, he goes underneath a tunnel, and it's sort of a parallel universe tunnel between, it goes from all the way from Romania all the way down underneath the Giza Plateau, where it goes into a real physical location.
Right.
Sooner or later, it gets to a real physical location, and there's a chamber underneath the Giza Plateau. And there's some corroboration to suggest that this actually does exist. And anyway, he finds a device there. He's shown a device by his mentor who's with him, Caesar Brad. And there's a device there where he can... It's basically very rarefied crystal architecture. And he's able to go back in time, sitting in a sort of a chair-like device where he can travel in time, but not physically. So that is sort of a remote viewing. It enables him to go back and see what happened in history, not necessarily his history, but an objective history according to what the book says. And he goes back and he observes. Actually, this is not him, if I recall. This is Caesar relating his experiences. This is Caesar relating his experiences of going back in time and seeing a 5'6" Jesus, was not so tall.
Yeah.
And basically seeing experiences and experiencing this experience, because it was an experience. It was most definitely an experience for Caesar, who is, by all accounts, to my knowledge, a very real person. But anyway, so that is not really remote viewing in the conventional sense. It's using a device that gives you the ability to go back and look at history and time and travel into time using a device. It's the most interesting thing about that experience is that when he tries, or that series of experiences, that when he tries to find out who made the device, who put it there, it's censored, it's blocked. So there's censorship. That's far more interesting than the experiences he talks about with Jesus, whether they're true or not, because they seem to have no... they're his experiences, but I'm saying is, who the hell made this device that enables you to go back and see either what happened or what you think happened,
right,
or what somebody influenced you to make you think happened. So, like, and it's very important, because I've written about so many interesting and fantastic things that I don't necessarily lose my head in the idea of belief. I said, well, these are his experiences, this is what he said, you know, what he said is his truth, or what he's telling us, it's not necessarily my truth, and I neither deny or accept what he says as being, because it's not my experience, it's his experience and his communication. This is very important, and of course it's interesting, and there's far more interesting things than that, as far as I'm considered, which goes into the fourth book of that series. I'm not trying to promote these books here in this conversation, although it is part of my job to promote my books, The Secret Parchment, Five Tibetan Initiation Techniques, which begins with Radu being sent to the United States of America to be part of a remote viewing program. So I can't escape this remote viewing theme in my work or my life. So that gets into another can of worms or butterflies, however you want to look at it. So that whole idea of the remote viewing reappears in the fourth book in the series. But back to wind it back to, we were talking about Ingo Swann and the experiences that one, this basically podcast is about what can happen, as it's turned into, when one finds oneself in a situation exterior of the body. If one is quote unquote lucky enough to have that happen. Manly P. Hall, in one of his lectures on, I think he's talking about psychic abilities, but he states very emphatically that if one does not have a pure and high purpose and has done a lot of work, and one goes to examine these areas, meaning the occult,
yes,
one is going to not have a good experience. These forces are going to knock him out. It's like going in a boxing ring and not really knowing what the hell you're doing or why you're there. Watch out for that fist.
Yeah.
And most people aren't going to be able to step into a boxing ring with a professional boxer, even in the gym, and fare too well. You know, and that's kind of what it's like. So if you've worked hard, prepared yourself, worked out, then you step in the ring, you might overcome that guy. And you're going to be as successful as to the degree you've worked and put into that. So it's very important. So when you have these people flying around in outer space or whatever you want to say, you have to, and you hear about them, you have to be very circumspect. And do you even want to talk about these people? Do you even want them in your life? Do you want Ingo Swann and all he's been involved with in your life? Well, Ingo Swann was somebody who was in my life from the first moment I heard of them, because we shared a common thread. And that sharing went beyond our involvements in Scientology. And it turned out that he was on the other side. And, you know, so he turned out to be not only a talented individual, but a problematic individual, if only to himself. And for all of the gifts that he had, it's very hard to admire or respect him. And you have to evaluate, and I'm kind of cutting forth a lot of stuff, but you have to cut forth is was he a flying monkey, or did he turn into a flying monkey, as opposed to Glinda the Good? And I'm using the Wizard of Oz analogy.
Yes.
Here.
Yeah.
Because he did not turn into Glinda the Good. At best, he turned into a flying monkey that was thwarted, at best. And because he was part of this team at the Stanford Research Institute that was using, and you know, he stated there were, like, I think 14 clears from Scientology that were used in these experiments. And the person I could not remember in the first podcast, I did take time to look that up. His name was Hal Putoff.
Okay.
Hal Putoff is was an engineer who I think he was a physicist too, if I'm not mistaken. But he was all involved in these experiences. And as soon as he does his upper levels of Scientology, he goes to the Stanford Research Institute and is doing remote viewing. And if you care to listen to him on YouTube, you might be bored half to death by what he's talking about. He's not a very interesting speaker. He's very mechanical. He speaks like an engineer, which he is.
Uh-huh.
And I think, why are you talking all this stuff? You could have said this in a few paragraphs. You know, whether you did all these experiences and all these experiments, and it's like, you know, you don't even know that what he's saying is true. And even if it is true, I can accept that it's true. Why do you have to tell us all these details? You know, do you want to hear, you know, about when I went out and had a piece of apple pie at the diner, and, you know, what the diner looked like, what the person next to me was doing? No. I mean, I had a piece of apple pie.
Yeah.
Big deal. It's like, he's not a very talented speaker, but or an interesting speaker. So, in any case, these people were deeply embedded into the government, and whether they became, Hal Putoff worked for the National Security Agency before he got involved with Scientology, And I don't know how that happened exactly. I wasn't around at that time. But people who worked in the high, had high security clearance in the government were not supposed to be able to have access to the upper levels of Scientology. That was an internal rule. Now, I don't know at what degree that rule came about, and it could certainly be missed or stupidly administered to. That's a lack of internal discipline.
Right.
And I don't know how all that stuff happened, and I was not on the watch when any of that happened. But the main point here is that the people that were involved in the government remote viewing experience, that or experiments that were so ballyhooed and whatnot during the 70s, they came right out of Scientology, and they were also recruiting other people from Scientology, and it might have been ones that were either gifted or their so-called spiritual signatures were tapped and they were brought there. They could have even been brought there independent of, like, what you say, a recruitment letter. You just kind of show up at the door and say, I'm here. That's how a lot of secret spook stuff works. And so this is remote viewing is not a sort of free and easy, you know, come to Disneyland, enjoy the day,
right,
and, you know, the friendliest place in the world, and you'll go back and have pleasant memories of being on the Dumbo ride. No. It is not that. It is like, you know, what is it? Once in the company, always in the company. Company meaning the CIA, that's what they call it colloquially.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we've got your psychic signature. And then you have people like Ingo disavowing Scientology publicly, distancing himself, whereas we've all been sort of forced to do that. But he distanced himself more than was actually genuine. Hal Putoff just slipped in and out. You know, there's a certain, he slipped in and out. He didn't, I have read where he joined a group that was anti the church. I don't know. He was married in the Church of Scientology, it says on the internet, which is probably true. And then Pat Price was the police commissioner of Burbank, I read. And he was the most gifted one, and he ended up dead under mysterious circumstances. So there, I guess the lesson here is, what are you getting involved with?
Right. Be careful what you wish for.
Well, yes. And remote viewing is, and not just for what the Scientologists say, but for what any spiritual tradition, or many spiritual traditions might say, is that you do have the ability to see beyond the physical perceptions of the body. And this is precept number one. You can do that. Now, just because you can do that, you know, you can also go into a bank and hold it up. It's not something you should do.
No.
You can also go into a room full of beautiful women and tell them that you want to marry one of them. You know, it's not a very good technique to attract a mate.
Right.
There's a lot of things you can do, and then the question is whether or not you should do them. So all I'm saying here is, in the first podcast we talked about, okay, remote viewing answered a lot of your questions. In this one, I'm making the theme more of a warning. You know, who are you? What are you doing? Why are you doing it? And what are you getting yourself involved in? And be aware of the dangers. Be aware of what is your purpose in life. Why do you want to go into these regions? And what are you going to accomplish? And you better be high-minded, because if you're not, you're going to end up in a less than desirable situation. It's, I'm not saying it's not the right way to go for an individual, but it's just like any decision you make in life, be respectful of yourself and be respectful to those who have gone before you and what might be out there instead of a wild, zealous enthusiasm. This is called sophomoric enthusiasm sometimes that people have. Oh boy, I can do this, I can do this.
Yeah.
And many people that get involved with this learn the hard way. And sometimes they don't learn at all. They're still learning the hard way.
Right. I don't have any goal with remote viewing. I would love to experience it. But like you said, with these warnings, there's a lot I've got to learn before I could even do it.
Well, I would say that the first door you opened was that experience you mentioned, that poetic experience of the breeze.
Yes.
Now that is a lovely experience. That is the beginning of your sort of reaching out, and it's, you know, and what I would also suggest to people, and I've given a very simple technique in the book The White Bat, the book that I recently wrote, The White Bat, The Alchemy of Writing, which gives a series of drills or experiences called the dark room, whereby you can go into complete darkness.
Right.
And this is not completely different than Plato's cave. In the cave work of Plato goes back to Tibet, where the monks used to go into the cave. And you're not just putting on a blindfold. You're going in, and it has to do with the whole skin being exposed to dark. You don't have to be naked or anything, but, you know, the whole experience in darkness. And when you go into darkness, and this drill is done 15 minutes a day, two or three times a day, and one begins to experience what one is. And one's not, you know, you'll see life come at you, and people have a hard time with this because they don't necessarily like what's in there. They don't necessarily, or they're afraid of what's in the dark of their own mind. And there's also techniques for scanning down, scanning out your aura, scanning out, moving down, moving energy down, and basically detoxing yourself. It's described in the book, and I know I've sent you the book, so you can
yes.
You can that. This is not the only way. Well, I've learned these techniques from my Qigong teacher, Grandmaster Roosevelt Ganey, bodyenergetics.tv or bodyenergetics.com. I don't know if that exercise is on there, because this is what I've learned from personal classes with him. But this can affect, scan out all the negativity, etc., in your aura. It's a way. I have done it with great success.
Right.
It is a key to mastering Qigong. You really can't master Qigong, but you can become very adept at it, and it's the key to becoming very adept at some of the highest levels of body, mind, spirit integration. And that's what I would recommend for you or anyone who wants to start out on basically, you know, coming into terms with your own spiritual self. It's a very good exercise. It's not how I started, but I wouldn't recommend necessarily going the route I did, because that was like over 40 years ago.
Okay.
And things are not the same.
Yeah.
And if I could bring you, you know, we all have different experiences. So, you know, you'll flow with your own experiences. And if you just, you know, you have to use your own mind. You
right.
know, I've given you information, and you can you have to evaluate that for your own rational and intuitive mind, and go with the flow
right.
of what you experience. And, you know, you are the ultimate decider of your own fate. These are just what I've experienced, and I'm happy to share it with you.
Well, I appreciate it. These conversations are truly, not only do I feel like my mind's more open to a lot of different things, but it also feels like it's expanding, maybe stretching its own boundaries. I'm just so curious about everything I can maybe be capable of. Reading about your past live experiences with Scientology, I kind of made me wonder, is there a point where a being becomes conscious of all these past lives and, you know, use it to make themselves a better person in their present?
I can only answer from my own experience.
Yeah.
And after experiencing probably, God, it might be thousands of hours, I don't know,
right,
of what you call regression therapy. And it was at some point, and I'm a very precise thinker, so, but as I say, with the Scientology auditing, some of the stuff I couldn't be too precise with or care too much about, because it all had to do with unwanted emotions or attitudes or predispositions I had. It wasn't really about dotting the I and crossing the T with regard to what happened in 1942, what happened in 1968 or whatever.
Right.
At some point, and I've sometimes wondered if this had to do with my general age, as I approached the age of, well, might have been 26, 27, I said, I don't care about all the details. I don't care about them anymore. Because I think that my mind was such that part of growing up to that age, you have so much storage capacity or random access memory in your brain.
Right.
Or that's related to your brain. And I could store up a lot of information. I said, this happened, that happened. And then I just let it all go. I said, you know, I don't need all this information. It's just a bunch of information.
Right.
And I let it go, and I didn't care about my past anymore. I mean, it's not that I didn't care, but I said, I don't need to hold on to all this past. And part of this is moving into what's called present time, into the now. And so it was like I was much more in the now. And the only thing I would say that I said, you know, well, if I've done all these things and accomplished all these things, I want to be in a position where I'm not going to be too vulnerable. Too vulnerable, in other words, I want all that positive experience that and accomplishments that I've made to stick with me. But I did not need to hold on to the past lives or this or that. Now, if you asked me if I wanted to use a past life to learn how to play the guitar, play it well anyway, beyond my current very limited knowledge of the guitar,
right?
I could go back and basically start going back and imagining myself as not only a guitar player but a mandolin player, whatever.
Yeah.
Go back into the track of time and start going into incidents that I'm either experiencing or creating, and going back into some of this. And at some point, the guitar will become a friendly thing to me, a familiar thing. And so when I see a guitar, I'll resonate with a guitar. I can ask my daughter who plays the guitar, you know, who wanted to teach me when she was young, but I had no time, or, you know, I did not have the time to learn from her. But, you know, you can just, that's how you do something. You know, you don't necessarily have to use your past lives, or you could use them, or the imagination of past life. You're using your imagination. I have that creativity to go back and learn how to do anything if I so choose to do it. And that goes back to what I said in the first podcast about moving out of fixed conditions. you know, so you can learn to do new things. It's very important to learn to do new things.
Right.
But it's just exercising your interest. And yes, you could use your... I remember hearing a story of somebody in my early days of Scientology who, you know, ran out of past life, and all of a sudden he could play the guitar and didn't know how he could play it.
Huh.
And that is not completely off the wall either, if you look at somebody like a Mozart who could play from scratch.
Right.
It's possible that anybody can play from scratch if they are inspired. All right, well, this wraps up our second podcast on the subject of remote viewing. And in the next one, we're going to go deeper into some of these issues and address some of the core issues of the subject.
Thank you for listening to the Peter Moon Podcast. To purchase Peter's books, visit skybooksusa.com. Also visit Peter's blog at digitalmontauk.com.
And to hear more music by Noosa, visit noosasounds.com.